So good evening, wayfarers. So a few weeks ago, a couple months ago maybe, Joan gave a series of talks that I know a lot of you listened to on mindfulness and concentration. And through Margot's good auspices, we played a lot of them in Tucson. I've been thinking about them. And the talk, one of the talks Joan gave at our retreat in Tucson also condensed some of that material. It was very rich to me, as it was to a lot of us, and I'm sure to a lot of you. So I wanted to talk tonight about just a couple of things that kind of grew out of her talks for me, a couple of things that lit up for me and that I wanted to take in particular directions. I wanted to thank in advance Jill and Cheryl from Tucson for their indulgence, because it's a version of a talk that I also gave in Tucson, and to congratulate Jen on her good luck for being out of town on business when I gave the talk. I'm going to start in a way probably that's a little abstract and then try and bring it down to cases and examples. And my hope throughout this is that, in addition to maybe some of it being of interest to you, that it may be of some use during the week. If you find yourself with nothing to do in the hall and can't figure out what to do on your cushion, some of this maybe will come back to you, and you might want to take some of it up. We'll see. So I want to start with a koan and just use it as a kind of movie trailer. I'm not going to talk about it, but it'll just be the trailer to the talk. And it's a little bit from the Blue Cliff Record Case 20 from the commentary of Yuan Wu, who's the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record. I want to apologize. I'm going to do really badly with one of the Chinese names at least. And I had it in my pocket when I went in for interview with Joan today and forgot to ask her about it, so I'm on my own. Anyway, Yuan Wu says, haven't you heard? Wu Shi went to see Shito. He had made an agreement with himself beforehand, saying, if there's a court at the first word, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll go. Shito just sat on his seat. She shook at his sleeves and went out. That shaking at your sleeves is that gesture of sort of great energy and contempt that Rinzai people are always doing to one another. So she shook at his sleeves and went out. Shito knew that she was a vessel of the truth, so he had extended his teaching to him. But she hadn't understood his meaning. He had announced his departure and gone out. When he got to the gate, Shito called out to him, Reverend! When she looked back, Shito said, from birth to death, it's only this. Don't seek any more for anything else by turning your head and revolving your brain. At these words, she was greatly enlightened. And then I have a second movie trailer, much shorter, from the children's author Maurice Sendak from the book In the Night Kitchen. And in that book, for any of you who haven't read it recently, there's a little boy named Mickey whose mother is pregnant again, and so he's going through his little traumas about it. And he wakes up one night and decides he's going to be naughty and sneak down to the kitchen and treat himself by baking himself a cake. So he pours out all the batter, and then he falls in. And when he falls in, he keeps singing to himself, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. I'm in the milk and the milk's in me. So that's the second epigraph on the way to thinking a little bit more about mindfulness and some aspects of mindfulness practice that Joan maybe touched on but didn't delve into. I want to start by reminding you, if you heard those talks, or trying to summarize a tiny bit if you didn't, that one of the things Joan does there is to suggest that mindfulness practice in America has in many instances been separated out from its context in among a host of other meditation practices, and most specifically concentration practice. And the talks talk really beautifully about the ways in which our sense of mindfulness practice will shift and be enriched and expanded once we put it back into that broader context. One of the things I'm sure you remember if you heard the talks that she points to is this sort of almost hyper-real awareness of the self in a mindfulness practice that's been divorced from its context. So, you know, Tenny with a kind of hyper-awareness being hyper-conscious of Tenny mindfully cutting the carrots. And one of the things Joan suggests is that as against that sort of single-minded focus, that we can begin to see the field expanding. And so first, in some sense, we become aware of other things in the field. And then, though she doesn't say it quite this way, I suppose, we become aware also of the various ways in which those other things in the field are aware of us as well. And I remember her example was, you know, not just cutting the carrots, but as you're doing it, you can feel the breeze out the window. Maybe these are not exactly the things she said, but the birds calling, you might be aware of somebody else cutting the onions. You might be aware of the water, you know, in the sink and so on. And then after a while, you begin to get a sense of all those things in some way being aware in their own way of you as well, and of a field of multiple awarenesses in which and of which your mindfulness is part. Walking meditations, at least for me, are a place where that happens a lot. I remember a lot of the walks at Mountain Cloud where we used to sit, really feeling greeted by the foliage that I went past, the wash, the tree where Jenny's statue was, and all those things. So then in a further expansion, and my recollection is that Joan just touched on this but didn't really say much about it, she also suggested that within the tradition, mindfulness can further be expanded, and I think it's a further expansion of this sense of multiple awarenesses in a field. Anyway, mindfulness can be expanded to include mindfulness of memory, or memory as mindfulness practice. And that's the thing that really lit up for me in a way. I said, oh, so that's what I've been doing all those years, and it's a way to situate itself. So I wanted to talk mostly for a few minutes about memory and or memory as mindfulness. And I want to say first that it's not a Bruce Springsteen invitation to tell boring stories of glory days. In my experience of it, and this would dovetail with certain other things that Joan has talked about, what will tend to happen in meditation is just a kind of stream of sense memories, a sense record, sense impressions that are really divorced from story, that seem to have no story or no point. The poet and Zen teacher Philip Whalen used to talk about his poetry as a continuous nerve movie, and in some way that's what it feels like. It seems really not, as I guess I just said, not really to have any dramatically important point or meaning. And in a way I want to come back to in a minute, I think its pointlessness or meaninglessness is a great part of its benefit. At any rate, those things can just kind of flow through us without rhyme or reason. In a way, it's as if there's some data downloading or, you know, backing up to a hard drive or copying itself or something like that. But it's very easy to get very mesmerized and lost in those streams of sense memory. I want to talk about a couple of characteristic qualities, at least for me, of those moments is the wrong word, but of those long periods of sitting with sense memories before I come back to the value of their pointlessness. The first thing I guess to say is that at least often they can seem very, very vivid, you know, particular things seen, maybe seen on the last walk that you took, maybe seen a couple of days ago, maybe seen in your childhood, just kind of coming back to you and washing over you. So it's not usually the case that I set out to practice with some series of memories, though I'll do that sometimes, but it just kind of comes over me. And at the same time that they're very vivid, they're oddly dreamy or insubstantial at the same time. And that seems to me, from a Dharma perspective, to be a kind of lucky hit, you know, both very there and very empty, very insubstantial at the same time, very dreamlike. Another thing to say, I suppose, is in some sense, those memories couldn't be you because they're of things out there in the world. But unlike encountering things in the present face to face, they must be inside you, they must be you, because where else are they coming from? So you're really accessing things that have become part of your inside in some way. And it seems to me at least possible that to a very large degree, there's no other you but that stuff. I mean, if you went looking for the part of you that wasn't in some way a memory or a trace or an impression of something that you'd encounter, I think it would be a pretty difficult search. So, you know, I'm in the milk and the milk's in me, interpermeation, that sense of really just inhabiting a space that's at once you and the only you that you can find, and traces of things outside you that have, I think they've been, I mean, you're there in some way because they've been in some way shaped by your own sensorium, your own way of processing things, your own bodily rhythms, but it's not possible, I think, to separate out the the you part from the not you part. So in terms of the pointlessness, some of you may remember another series of talks that Joan gave a little bit longer ago on self and soul. And she spent a lot of time talking about the soul, which in her usage at that point was the place in us where there is no story, where there is no narrative, where there is no meaning. And that place, like the place I've been talking about, is really a place that's a collection of sense memories or a kind of sense record. One of her images for it that I think is partly borrowed from the Buddhist tradition is of a kind of pond into which a series of leaves fall at various times, and they fall in patterns and layers, but there's no agency there to tidy them up into neat little piles. So they're kind of random, they're very rich, they layer, they accrue, they get moved by the space that they're in. So it's a place in the mind that's not structured by narrative or meaning. Joan talks in those talks, and I know this mostly from her, though a little bit from reading around in Hakuin, that in the tradition that place is also called the storehouse consciousness or the Alaya Vishnyana. And Joan talks in one of those talks that you may remember about how that space of the storehouse consciousness is also associated, at least within, I think, Mahayana tradition, though maybe not only, with the Tathagata Garbha, with the womb of the Tathagata, of thus come, thus gone, suchness. That's one of the names of the Buddha. And in that sense, that space of the storehouse consciousness is either the place in which we might awaken or the place in which our awakening already is, if we can only access it. One of the things that means is that your awakening is already in you. And to go back to the kind of place where I started with these sense memories and so on, another thing it might mean for practice is that this can be a really rich area of practice without having to do a whole lot with it. I mean, it seems kind of pointless in a way maybe, but if it's feeling rich, if it's feeling powerful, just to immerse yourself in that kind of sense record of sense memory is to go to a place that's very, very deep and is in some sense already the space of your own enlightenment. I would say that for me anyway, most of the deepest and most transformative meditation experiences I've had have been at least partly cued by or taken up with experiences like that, just sinking into the sense memories. So I want a drink. I wanted to liven it up just a little bit. It won't get too lively ever, but I wanted to liven it up just a little bit and also maybe make it a little clearer and also maybe bring in a couple of more nuances of it by talking about two fairly recent, well, it's actually one, it's one recent trip and two places, but really one experience. So a couple months ago, I went up from Tucson north to Flagstaff, which isn't exactly like this terrain, but it's kind of halfway between this terrain and Tucson terrain, just on a school trip with one of my kids where it turned out I thought I was just family, but I got roped into being a chaperone, which wasn't always great, but that's not the point of the story. And anyway, one of the things we did on the way back is some people wanted to do a little sightseeing, and we visited Sunset Crater and also the Wupatki Ruins. And it was a very powerful and wonderful experience for me while I was there. And I came back to Tucson and I hadn't sat for a few days. And I thought, okay, you know, time to sit down and get back to the koan that I'm working on. And instead, the memories of those places just started washing through me. And I just sat with that for 3 or 4 days. I mean, I couldn't tear myself away from it. So I just say a couple things about those places and the feeling of sitting with that. I'm sort of good at poetry and I'm not very good at science, so a lot of this is going to be really inexact, I'm sure. But Sunset Crater is a series of volcanic mountains, and I had always thought of volcanoes as the things that blow their tops off, but apparently a lot of them kind of dissolve from the bottom or from the middle, and so the lava kind of comes pouring out underneath the top, and so you get a top of the mountain that's still fairly intact, and then these giant hillsides of this very black volcanic substance. And apparently the last eruption there was something like 1,000 years ago, so it's really, really old. Up amid those big sweeps of volcanic ash, there are very, very isolated conifers regrowing. So there are a lot of them, but they're widely spaced by the ash. And that's, you know, a kind of slow growth thing. And then further down, closer to where we were walking, there's a lot of kind of thicker foliage that's obviously a lot younger. And then really delicate, beautiful flowers right at the base of the ash. And then also part of my experience of it, of course, was grown-ups, you know, the group that I was with kind of trudging through it, and then the kids kind of capering through it, and also lots and lots of birds moving through it. So one of the things that I was really conscious of, I think partly because of all the signage around that was explaining to me some stuff, but, you know, there are things about how old the volcano is, when the regrowth started, and so on. But I was very aware, in a way that I sometimes am anyway, of what I might call sort of multiple time signatures around me. So the quickest thing would be the birds, you know, really moving through that landscape, then the kids moving at a pretty quick pace, then the grown-ups, and then, as I said, you know, just the flowers, which were very recent and moved in the breeze really lightly and quickly, the thicker foliage that moved more slowly, and then those trees. And so here, in a way, you had to have done a little bit of reading or inferring, but those trees, which seemed really, really still, but were quite a bit younger and were growing and changing at a really different pace than the volcanic ash, which was going to take, I think, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of years to really change in a significant way. It's really interesting when, it's a little bit like what some of Michael was talking about, it's really interesting when you can immerse yourself in a time of bells and walking and sitting and sunrise and breezes and so on, and get off clock time in some way. So clock time, which I guess is fairly recent in terms of being something that everybody was attuned to, I think it's the 18th century when a lot of people started wearing wristwatches and really thinking of their time in relation to clock time on a momentary basis. But in clock time, every single thing is calibrated against a single standard that's very mathematically regular and in some sense very abstract. If you go off clock time for a while, then in some sense time happens only in the comparative tempos between two different things. You know, so I mean, I didn't calibrate it this way, you know, but, you know, how many times do the birds go through while I'm walking through the landscape? How fast does the shrub grow in comparison to the movement and stillness of the conifers? How about the time of the conifers in relation to that epical time of the volcanic ash? And so my sense would be that certainly when I came back and sat down, I was aware of it while I was there, but one of the ways in which those sense memories were present to me was really as a kind of bodily sense of different tempos and different time signatures that I was sitting inside, and then also the time signatures of my own body sitting and moving and walking. And to me anyway, that feels, I guess it sounds kind of abstract, but it feels like a very rich and really visceral kind of interpenetration. I mean, it's funny to call it I'm in the milk and the milk's in me, because it's just about movement and time, but something like that is really there. And then I also, just pushing things a little bit, I wanted to say also that for me anyway, it feels really rhythmic and also kinetic, sort of tied to my own bodily movements. So I could think of a couple of sense memory examples that are pretty unassailably instances of that you might have some memory or association with. So one would be, if you've been out on a boat, anybody ever been out on a boat for a long time during the day, you know, when you lie down to bed, you can feel the motion of the boat in your body, and it's so, so beautiful. Another one, I guess, would be it's true a little bit if you just get up and boogie, but if you learn some dance that you actually have to take a while to learn, that has particular steps that your body has to learn, when you go to sleep or some other time, you can really feel those dance steps in your body. A lucky hit for me today, which I hope some of you can associate with, was that moving through the labyrinth had that same kind of feeling. I feel like that's going to be in my body tonight, those kind of sharp turns and the feeling in those turns of the turning of myself in relation to the stones, and then that against the movement of somebody walking straight past me. You know? So I want to say that in a maybe just somewhat more abstract way. I really felt the rhythms and the movement and the kinetics of those places moving through me. I want to go back. I skipped something in my mind. I should go back and pick it up quickly. So the one other thing I'd bring in is from Wupatki, which is about a 1,000-year-old Indian ruin, as I said. There's again that sense of multiple time signatures, you know, the kids scampering around the landscape, the adults tromping around it, the buildings decaying at a very, very slow rate. And then also a little bit more of that sense of it was a very hot day, the heat of the sort of high desert, and the light, which was very, very, very bright. And I want to suggest that in some way, the light and the heat were a kind of sort of bass rhythm underneath all of that. I don't know if any of you have seen the movies by Peter Weir, the terrific Australian director, and particularly Walkabout, but Weir is terrific at that, getting that sound that's on the soundtrack that's also associated with the glaring light that you can see. And there's something about the sound, at least for me, that I can't tell if it's really there or if I'm imagining it. It's sort of like the world's largest and faintest didgeridoo or something like that. But you don't know whether it's the sound of the blood in your own ears, the sound of the crickets, the sound of the landscape. And it has some association because of that brightness, it seems to me, with this really bright stillness that's moving at the same time. And that's a lot like the feeling of awakening, it seems to me. So that kind of 0 degree underneath all of it. So I'm going to try and talk about a couple other things pretty quickly if I can, because I've gone on for a fair amount of time already. So that's the mindfulness part, and I want to do just a little bit with concentration, if that's all right. I'm glad that we read the Shitto this afternoon for the afternoon reading, because I want to use that as a pivot, the beginning especially, or toward the beginning. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. So underneath that brightness, the darkness. And I want to go back to the topography, even though it's kind of a cheap shot, because it's just a lucky detail of the landscape. But at Sunset Crater, it turns out that underneath what you can see, though you can walk down into it a little bit, there are these enormous caves, somehow these big hollow spaces that were blown out by the activity of the volcano. And they're ice caves. And so there are these enormous caves of ice under the landscape. And I had been told that we could actually go down and see the ice, though we didn't quite do that. But you could get close enough so you could feel this icy air kind of wafting up towards you. And of course, being a Zen student, I couldn't just leave it at that, but it made me think immediately when Linji is talking about working on no as a concentration meditation. He says it was like being in an ice cave a million miles thick. And then Hakuin, in a related vein, says the whole universe was sheer darkness. So underneath that landscape, in some sort of literal way anyway, there's that space of the ice cave, of the darkness, of the dark mysterious, of the dark well under that landscape. And in the series of talks that Joan gave about concentration and mindfulness, she talks about concentration meditation as letting us sink down into that vastness. When I gave a version of this talk in Tucson, some of the people in the group were really new meditators and so probably didn't have a concentration practice. I'm sure almost all of you have really developed concentration practices, so I want to just say a couple things that I'm sure most of you are already aware of, and then just for a second bring it back to the issue of landscape and memory. So my understanding or misunderstanding of concentration practice is that whether we're doing no or a mantra or even breath counting, that in some way what's happening is we're giving our mind something to work on that doesn't have a whole lot of incredibly complicated content. And so many things can happen when we do that. One thing that can happen is that the mind tends to really become aware of itself. As the external content thins out, the attention is drawn inward to the mind itself. And at some point, there's attentiveness or attention to what feels like almost nothing, and the mind sees the mind. for me anyway, at the same time, that sense of paying attention to less and less very often also leads to a feeling of kind of external things falling away. I think physiologically, it may have a simple explanation of just the eyes rolling up into the head at some point, but it really feels like the things in the world are falling away from me at great speed, you know, until finally there's nothing or almost nothing, and we've entered the space of the dark mysterious. And so, as all of you know, that can be peaceful or calm or intimate or vast or scary or intimidating. And then, if we're lucky or if we sit long enough, something else happens and it turns into something else. In terms of the practicalities, again, which I'm sure all of you know, but it's going to lead me where I want to go, one of the things that I find happens, you know, sometimes with this is, I don't know, the motor gets sort of overheated or overcharged, you know, that there's so much energy in it that it starts blowing steam or something like that, or you feel like you're going to sort of blow your own top. At that moment, and again, I'm sure most of you know this, turning towards something like a mindfulness or permeability practice may be a good thing to do. And my sense is that, and here I'm going to use landscape in a just slightly metaphorical way, it seems to me, but that if it's true that you sink into something in a concentration practice, in a way you've entered a different space or a different landscape. To me anyway, it feels partly like something like the space of the body, the space of the sort of the dark inside of the body and the somatic qualities of the body, that's the space I'm moving around in. In a way, it feels like a little glimpse of the dark mysterious. And I'm heartened that Yunmen in a koan that Joan talked about a couple of years ago talks about everybody carrying a little shard of eternity within them. And Joan says that she associates that not with light, but with that darkness. So if there is that little shard of darkness, you know, right there in the tanden, in some way the space that we can become mindful of maybe really is the space of the dark mysterious and the space of the body at the same time. At any rate, it seems to me that you can do something like, it's not memory anymore, I guess, but you can do something like a mindfulness or permeability meditation with something like landscape when you're pretty deep in a concentration meditation. I'm almost done. I wanted to talk about one more thing that I think a lot of you probably also know about, but it might be useful to be reminded of it in a retreat. And that would be this issue. Whether you're in a, if you're in a really deep meditation, if you're in a place where things are opening, it might be that space of the dark mysterious. It might be that space of that moving and bright light that we can know. It's also the case, I forgot I want to say also that, and again, you all know this, but one of the really vital things that can happen in meditation is those things turning into or morphing into one another. So the bright turning into the light turning into the bright, the stillness turning into the time signatures of all those things moving around. So at any rate, if you're in that space where things are open and one of those things seems like it's going to fulfill itself in some way, come to fruition, or one of them's about to sort of flip over and turn into the other, just a couple, mostly quotations here, maybe things that might be more useful than other things to do or not to do. So Suzuki Roshi, and this isn't a precise quotation, but says someplace something like, for a lot of the way you have to make a really intense effort, and then at the very last moment, you have to make no effort at all. He also says in another place, I've learned how to wait. So just waiting in that space. The romantic poet Wordsworth talks about wise passiveness. His sidekick and greater romantic poet Keats talks about negative capability. I mean, when a person is capable of remaining in the midst of doubts, mysteries, and uncertainties without any irritable reaching after fact or reason. Joan says sometimes in a formulation I love that in those moments, you don't have to try to do any more, you just have to do a little less. There's another time a long time ago that Joan talked about gendered images of this space and of what we do there. And it's a little awkward as a guy to talk about them, but I want to risk it just for a moment because I think it's important. She said in that talk, which was at Mountain Cloud a long time ago, that the tradition is full of images of pushing on through or breaking through the barrier, you know, a kind of samurai phallic bravado, you know, you're going to smash right through that thing. And she said that at a certain point she was getting really tired of that and that she would like to see that supplemented by images of being permeated or being filled. And just as one guy, I want to say that in my own experience, that those images turned out to be a lot more useful and a lot truer to my experience than that notion of having to blast through something with a great and powerful effort. Okay. Another way to talk about it, just slightly related, the language philosopher Wittgenstein talks at some point, I think in the Philosophical Investigations, about the phrase, stand roughly there. And he's doing battle at that point with the logical atomists and the guys who are saying, if language is going to work right, it's going to be as absolutely precise and unambiguous as mathematics or logic. You know, and he says, that's bullshit. That's not how it works. So he says, okay, if I say stand roughly there, you can tell me that I'm not being precise, that I should have told you exactly where to stand, but that's bullshit. What I mean is stand roughly there. You know, we're playing basketball, go stand roughly there. That's not an imprecise way of telling you where I want to stand. It's a precise way of talking about really a fuzzy boundary situation or fuzzy logic, okay? So it seems to me that if you're in this place, it's not, you know, sort of waiting for something to come to fruition or to shift, you know. It's not often most useful to say that you're not quite there and you have to push on through a little harder in order to cross a definite line in a definite way. It's probably more useful to say instead that you just have to try your best to stay in that fuzzy in-between space where you're, you know, close to it. And in that place, you have to keep your heart as open as you can. And as Joan says, you have to stay fetchable. So, as Wittgenstein might say, sit roughly there. Thank you. So, I, of course, welcome any comments or discussion. Yeah.
I was fascinated that you brought this up because it was what I wanted to talk about today.
Oh, great.
I want to go back to the sense memory thing because I was in New Orleans a week ago, Thursday, for 6 days. And really didn't like it because it was so hot. But what's happened and came up is these incredibly vivid sense memories of the places that I visited, or the landscape, actually, urban, and in one case, a bayou and a park. And I can't stop it, you know. So then what happened, this is what I didn't know what to do about it. First, a poem started forcing its way up. You know, I'm like, this isn't meditation. Stop it. You know, I could not stop it. And then it turned into a short story.
Yeah.
So I was like, down spot. I couldn't stop the energy and the flow. Yeah. And so a couple of questions. I mean, is that meditation?
I'm scared to answer that. the sort of joke answer, which I don't mean would be the poem's okay, but the story's not.
But, yeah, I mean, the poem's a story.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay. Can I go back to the poetry thing? I mean, you know, what happens to me a lot is that I'll get phrases from poems that I've read, and more rarely, you know, just some poem that I want to write, and it seems to me that those are often, I don't know, they're ways of naming or getting at rather than analyzing what's rich in that sense memory for you. So to me, it feels pretty close to meditation. Sometimes I'll bring phrases from poems to Joan and want to talk about them. To some extent, I feel like I don't want to go too far down that road when I'm in the hall. So I'll try to put it on a shelf and pull it down later in some way. But I don't, I mean, in ways that Joan and the tradition talks about, I don't want the, you know, no narrative or no story thing to be understood as a prohibition against words, because I don't think that's how it works. I don't know. I wonder sometimes, too, you know, it's like, oh, a whole lot of the time at Okamura, I just, I was sort of between Coens, you know, because I had worked on something and I was waiting to get in to see John and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to work on next. So I just said, oh, I don't know what else to do anyway, so I'll just, you know, the landscape is happening, so I'll just do it. And I, you know, I never got my hand slapped for it. It felt very rich, you know, and very powerful.
So are you saying that you just let the sense memories arise and be with them?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if it starts getting really narrative, then I drop it. You know, oh, that's where my dog threw up the bone or something like that. You know, but often it really does settle into something like that sense of multiple time signatures, which feels, again, really like a meditative space to me. Do you know what I mean? That just something very still, certain other things moving in relation to it, my thinking sort of wafting through or not in relation to those things. And again, I think, I hope I'm not misunderstanding this, but I think there's some warrant in the tradition in terms of that stuff about the storehouse consciousness and what Joan said about it for understanding that, maybe even within the tradition, though I know it mostly through Joan and I may be misunderstanding what she's saying, but understanding that as a very fruitful space and a space that's very close to awakening. You know, so yeah, my if I were given the advice, I would say you go with it, you know. Yeah.
Surprisingly this week I've noticed memories want to attach themselves to my mouse than wearing my mouse. And it's been an interesting process to see to write one and then come back the next day and see if it still holds or if it was just sort of an easy way to go.
Yeah.
And some of them are holding it, some of them aren't, but it's as if these memories they don't want to be forgotten.
Yeah.
So there's a way that they're sort of, you know, attaching.
That's great. What it makes me think of is my sense that the Coens are very close to that also. Every once in a while, if you're working on it, not you, me, if I'm working on a Coen not very well, it gets allegorical a little too quickly. Oh, the snow in the silver bowl is just, you know, an image of, right? But the snow is going to be an image or a symbol or some bad word like that for some abstraction. But really, we know the abstraction only because we live in the sense fields that we do. Do you know what I mean? I mean, think how different your whole world would be and really even probably your conceptual structure. I mean, you know, if there were no trees or no snow. I mean, what would your sense of stillness be if there were no trees, no snow, no water, you know? So it seems to me that if it attaches to a particular sense memory, that's very much in the Coen mode of working and very real and very powerful, you know. Yeah. It's also fun to listen to, right? You know? Do you know what I mean? And those will be vows that are nice to hear. Yeah.
So do dreamscapes go in this?
Yeah.
Or this material?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I'm a bad dreamer lately. I used to dream a lot and I'm starting to dream, but I'm very jealous of all of you who have the interpermeating dreams in awakened life. And when I'm around Joan, I've started to remember my dreams a little more and they seem really rich and part of the same thing. But, you know, I'm not the best person to talk to about it. But yeah, I think for sure.
Denny, I think you're talking about the unconscious, you know, in another language.
Yeah.
Which, you know, feels, you know, like something in my experience that it's in Zen, but it's sort of like we don't quite, I'm really grateful.
Yeah, no, thank you. I would like to, you know, explore that with you at some point because I'm pretty confused about it. I mean, and I don't want to go too far down this road right now, but I don't, in a way, if there's no language at all in it, it's the unconscious. But if you think about it not as repressed material, but just as material that didn't rise to the level of consciousness, then it's more like the preconscious, right?
I'm not talking about
okay.
the repressed.
Okay,
I'm
yeah,
about,
right.
Yeah.
Right, but so I don't know if that's the unconscious or...
Yeah.
Or the preconscious. And then also, you know, in the D.T. Suzuki Zen doctrine of no mind, there's all that stuff about waking up in the unconscious. And so it drives me bats trying to figure out how to map what he means by unconscious about what somebody coming out of a psychoanalytic tradition would mean by it.
Well, we'll hash it out sometime.
Yeah, I think it's really great. Yeah.
But I have a question, though. For me, you know, what you're talking about, these sense memories, I'm fascinated by the way you described them, because it almost seemed unemotional. In my experience, I also have a similar kind of experience, but it's in completely infused with emotion, not emotion attached to a story.
Yeah.
Not like, you know,
yeah.
when I was a kid and I, you know, got
yeah.
into trouble with my mom, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Right.
But it's just like pure
yeah.
sort of emotion.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm
yeah.
curious about
yeah, for me it's usually full of warmth and light. Who knows? I mean, maybe it's, I can't think of any other time but summer now in a way. But I mean, a lot of it seems summery, you know, it seems like stuff flowering and coming to fruition is what I remember. Though, around the time when Joan was giving talks on snow in a silver bowl, I can't even remember the details anymore, but I had a lot of snow stuff going on. We worked on the two Wallace Stevens snow poems as a Cohen and Tucson, you know, now I can't remember them, never mind. You know, the last one is, it was evening all afternoon. Oh, the first one is, among 20 snowy mountains, the only moving thing was the eye of the blackbird. And then the last and 13th one is, it was evening all afternoon, it was snowing and it was going to snow. The blackbird sat in the cedar limbs. And so that felt really spare, but really, I don't know, really, really bare, you know, the bare field, the blessings, but really comforting and calm at the same time. Yeah. So mostly the things that I sit with have one version or another of the warmth, or openness, or falling open quality that you're talking about. So thanks for bringing that up. Yeah. Yeah, Annie.
Because when it arises with people, it's harder to keep the story.
Yeah, yeah. I don't. Yeah. What usually if I do if I do a people meditation, it's usually, you know, a difficult meditation and I'm working something through, you know. So there's something too bad about that, right? It's that it's easier to love landscape and animals than to sit calmly with people. But yeah, I have the same experience. Another thing is it's certainly easier to, I guess you just said this, but it's easier, it's harder to keep the narrative out of it.
Yeah.
But then, yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting that sometimes, well, just kind of looking back through the time, the abundance of my sense memories would come and go. And I don't get them very often now, but I used to sometimes be flooded with them, you know,
yeah.
for weeks at a time. It could be disoriented and it could be fun as well.
Yeah.
But it was as if I would just be sitting in my front room and I could be at Mountain Cloud again, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
I could smell without smelling the pines and feel without feeling the way the meditation hall felt
yeah.
when you walked in.
Yeah.
And things like that. Or I could be someplace else and, or maybe a thought would be a thought I had at some other place.
Yeah.
You know, it would usually be place kind of dependent. Or sometimes time dependent, a way I felt when I was six, or a way I was five when I was walking through the woods or
yeah.
something, you know.
Yeah.
And it was this uncanny thereness of the experience,
yeah.
but yet at the same time I'm also experiencing what's happening right now.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like you're having two completely different experiences
oh, yeah.
kind of
yeah.
interlaced together at the same
yeah.
time.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, at least for me, I feel like that's a very deep part of me, and that, you know, I wouldn't exactly know where to find a tenny that wasn't
yeah.
sort of tinged by that. The other thing, just to go back to something a little bit like dreams, I think certainly and this goes back in a way to what Megan was bringing in, that moment when you're falling asleep is, you know, or falling asleep in the hall, you know, either one, is very rich for that kind of thing to happen too.
Types of sense memories. We're talking about the kind of sense memories that actually have things that you're working out, you know, from your past. I mean,
oh, yeah.
when I first started meditating, you know, there was, I don't know, months, if not years of that stuff. And then that sort of went away. But I was thinking that a lot of the koans seem to be sense memories.
Yeah.
I mean, one that I've been walking around with lately has to do with asking the difference between speech and silence and person answers. You know, I'm thinking that the monk answers, the teacher answers. I'm thinking about partridges and the flowers at, you know, Chen Yan Mountain.
Yeah.
And that's a sense memory.
Yeah.
Or you know, when I'm in Kyoto, I miss the sound
Yeah, I think that's right.
Cuckoo. And I'm thinking, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that
isn't that
just,
great? Yeah.
And so the one that I just talked about with the koans seems meditative to me. And the ones where you're working out your shit from your past does not seem very meditative.
Yeah.
It seems like you're working out shit from your past.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to talk about the working out shit from the past ones. No. I don't mean we shouldn't talk about it. But no, I'm talking about an experience that's much more like your experience of koans, where, and just what Michael was saying. You know, so I'm sitting there, and for no reason, you know, why the tree in the front yard or the place where I spent summers when I was 13 that I can see really vividly, and also has that dreamy sort of emptiness quality about it. My reaction to Joan is so much a presence for all of us, you know. So when you said the thing about koans, it was just, how great is that? You know, I mean, that's right. I mean, that's what, you know, and you know, literature works the same way, right? That you can have sense memories of stuff that you never saw. And so something about the shared quality or the communal quality of it and the community ferry boat and all that, it seems to me. And yeah, the koans, if you sit with them for a while and they've got some imagery in them, you know, they really do, I think. But you know, you take them so seriously, or you work with them with so much energy, that they really do become part of that sensorium too, which I think is great. Yeah.
I think what's happening, you know, when we say sense memory, I think what's happening is that the same parts of the brain are activating that we're activating during the sense during the experience. So you're getting the same neural circuits recruited at that moment, and that's what it feels like it's happening. And what I want to tie that to is, you know, this thing about the unconscious. I mean, I think that haiku and koans are very close, because I think they are really situated in sense memory. And so it's, and John Donahue, you know, Dan Siegel's pal who died, says that the imagery from poetry arises in the right hemisphere. Even though it's words, it's not the narrating function of the left. And I've had that, I'm sure you've had that experience.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that the words just come like images. Yeah.
And the right hemisphere is the map of the body.
Yeah.
So that's where it all comes together, where it's starting to come together.
Yeah. I don't know anything about what you're talking about. I hope it's all true, you know. Right? I mean, it sounds great.
Well,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, it does respond and it enriches it, and that's great. Thank you, David. Yeah.
I remember hearing Richard Baker one time did a whole weekend on the skandhas, and he chose to focus really strongly on sensation. You know, this the next thing from form, and he talked about sensation actually exactly the way you're talking about sense memories, and what. I guess what I'm playing with is, how are these things formed? And, you know, because there's really, it's not like there's memories that have a story attached to them, where there's some sense of self and there are other selves, and so you kind of laid all this stuff onto what's happening, and then that's the memory. Or there's another kind of memory that has no story, and all it is a fragrance, or all it is a tapestry of sound. It's not either or, because I think I almost feel like withdrawing from the stories is such a unique, unusual way to be. You know, that the stuff that falls unfiltered into the storehouse memory, there's little stories attached to a lot of it.
Yeah, I'm, again, I
think it's so hard to escape that. But I've had some experiences that I guess I would describe as kind of mini Kensho experiences, where I've kind of lost track of who I am. The time stops. Everything seems perfectly interwoven. It's all brilliant and beautiful. And those are times when I've had those, the memories I have of those are of the sensations, the sensory experiences. So it's almost like they're rare. They're rare to have these memories without very much story in them at all.
Can I just say what it, make up an answer, which I don't know if it's true, but it might be. It seems to me that one of the things that happens on a retreat is that the, you know, the threshold in terms of what can become conscious gets lowered, sort of more stuff gets in there. You know, there's that story about the Graham Peachy, the Suzuki guy who was going to become a teacher and then went to England, back to England too long, who sat the month-long retreat and said by the end he could hear the bugs moving on the floor behind him and stuff like that, you know. So I think in a way it really is odd to walk around really being aware that you're registering the look of all the leaves and the grass and the sound of the birds and stuff like that. And I think, and again, I don't know what to do with the Freudian topographies exactly, but if you think about what I'm talking about in terms of Freud's preconscious, that really is the stuff that your sensorium takes in that doesn't rise to the level of relevance or importance for you to make conscious and attach language to it. I think that's right. And
because
so,
you have it superimposed in the worldview.
Well, no, it's just, you know, you couldn't, unless you were taking acid all the time or something, I mean, you couldn't get along in the world without, Freud talks about consciousness as a lightning rod, and one of its main functions is to not make conscious, to, you know, to dispel about probably about 99% of the stuff that, you know, bombards our sensorium in any moment. So my sense is that probably there is a lot of sense memory down there that, you know, didn't get story attached to it. That it's, I don't know if that's true though, I mean, you know, I'd like to know more about it.
I was going to say, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I get, Zen doesn't necessarily make a hard distinction between conscious and unconscious. Not to say that we experience all of it at the same time, but I think part of what happens with the koans is you start to gain a wider or deeper access of the way you make sense or nonsense of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and I think through time, through the koans and through the hours of sitting, what we can traditionally consider to be unconscious gets very close.
Yeah.
And sometimes it feels very paper thin.
Yeah.
And then sometimes the paper falls away as well.
Yeah. I don't know enough to answer, so I'm going to jump tracks and give a, you know, sort of probably reasonably correct Freudian answer, which is that, because it's the model I know better. So Freud says that there's a lot of stuff that he would call compromise formations, right? And what that means is that there are certain mental activities or formations that he thinks are shaped partly by consciousness and partly by the agency of the unconscious. And it's exactly stuff like dreams, or, you know, what goes through your head in those moments of being about to fall asleep that are like that. And I think that koans, you know, this goes back to what Ellen was saying also, that koans and some poems also access that terrain.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know quite how to map that onto. I don't know if anybody else wants to answer that.
I mean, it seems like maybe that's territory, at least as Joan talks about it, the Sambhogakaya.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you have your Dharmakaya, your sort of vastness, undifferentiated, and then the Manakaya, which is the form, right? And there's this place where, as far as I can tell, includes dreams, memories, but it's sort of the intersection, but there's also not the, not the, I mean, you can't be discounted. It doesn't matter if there's a story, if there's not a story. It's a memory, or if it's a dream, unless, you know, I suppose if you're working things out, but there's, talking about it as a place where creativity happens, and it seems like it's almost the most important place in the koans because it's the place where you attach, you know? I mean, I think the thing with koans is, in my, like, very small experience, but there seems to be sort of this, it calls for you to sort of, I don't know, it calls to you. How is this koan you? And how do you do that without that piece of your whole life, which is so rich, and it's so not real, but it's so compelling, and it's so much a part of who we are. I'm not really saying this very well, but it does seem like
it's
that middle ground. It's not real, it's not real, but it's completely part of the landscape. You can't really deny.
Yeah, I think that's just right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's like when the world takes on a dreamlike quality, and it feels very much more like a dream than it does concrete.
Yeah.
Is that not real?
Is that a question? Pat, yeah.
This is really exciting, interesting territory for me, and I kind of want to validate, I resonate so much with so much of what has been said, and what Ellen said. I'd like to say is true, and as we know more, it will all change, right? But just speaking to the little bit that I think I know about neuroscience, and the little bit that I think I know about, Zen and the practice, and I agree with what Michael said about as we practice and meditate, it just gets bigger and it goes into different layers. I think that we sometimes think of the unconscious as some sort of storehouse, like in the basement of a government building, or old food supplies, things from records from God knows what, whether records are going or something. And there are all these sorts of things. It is such an alive place, and neurologically, there's connections from the three primary parts of the brain throughout the body, traveling to the gut, so when you get a gut instinct, it's not just a grandmother thing, it's real, and it's a viable sort of very alive thing. And I think when we're talking about sense memories and stuff, the thing that just popped right up for me is, Proust and Madeline, in fact, there's a great book that I highly recommend to everybody called Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. And it goes into, Proust and Cézanne and several different Escoffier and several different people in terms of what their experience and what their understanding was, and tracing that back to the part of the brain. So, like what Margot was talking about, and all these different filtration systems and making the column part of who we are, all of this stuff comes up. And they've been able to look at CAT scans and various, MRIs and various things, and find out that so much knowledge is being synthesized and processed in that unconscious storehouse that we think is just the old place. And then it does bubble up, and it does come out in quirky ways, and it does stick its, finger in your ear when you're thinking of a thought. And so, as part of that whole infinite picture of all of this, there's no place that's a rest of it. It's put away somewhere, and only accesses, and that we only access in some peculiar way. It's all alive and happening.
What Pat's saying is what neuroscience is showing. I can't. That it's not a vertical and a horizontal organization necessarily. Things are happening in the brain all over, all the time. And that's fascinating to me. And in terms of the creative energy, there's a lot of new research about that, and if they're fine, you literally have to turn down your frontal lobes because they get in the way. And if you've done any creative work, you know that. Yeah. And I've just been reading a whole book about the neuroanatomy of creativity. It's very interesting. But Shelley Carson's the author, and she talks about that and how to learn to do it. All of which is to say, I have been holding this question, and I'll hold it until I die. How do the koans change your brain?
I know they change
your brain.
Yeah.
I just don't have the whole picture.
Yeah.
There's actually a lot of work, imaging work, that shows how meditation changes the
way. I know meditation, but I'm talking specifically about comment study, which is different.
So
anyway, it's just, I mean, the sense that it's very much atmosphere oriented.
I feel like this discussion just makes me have an image. I feel like a retreat is so wonderful because I feel like I'm in a movie theater. I have like, because everybody calls this container, and you have your own space, you have your own movie theater. You can use your whole body, your brain, your body, your sensation, different kinds of sensation to fully experience this of whatever arise from who knows, 100 years ago, 5 years ago, now, future, who knows. But then at the end, maybe some lights come arise, you can have some understanding now, and then maybe then the other story comes, the other movie comes. And that feels very beautiful.
Yeah, great, thank you.
You know, I think it's like feels very limiting to me to just be thinking about this practice in terms of my brain. Like it seems like I've spent 3 to 5, however really long they've been, is to try to train. That's a trap. And you know, in reading, we've been reading the Mahavatara Sutra as a study group, and I brought it up once already, but it seems to me that the Buddha's teaching, when you get down to the very end of it, which is really disturbing, I mean, this one phrase that's just haunting me is there is no external existence, and that when we talk about the sense memories, that's a stage of one stage of meditation, and I know there's all sorts of, do we reject stages, incorporate stages, do we like stages, is that Tibetan? But, you know, but that's getting stuck there, and I don't mean stuck, is not, that doesn't feel as liberating to me. I mean, and so when we bring up this, what I consider for me a very touchy topic about what's going on in the cushion, because, you know, we don't talk about it very much, I think we're all, you know, wondering, at least I'm always wondering, is what the fuck am I sitting here 10 hours a day? what that just happened today? I just wonder. But when other people, when I read about what the Buddha says or I read about what other people are talking, like, I think there is something bigger than what's happening here that I don't know the tools yet.
What I guess all I can say to that is that for me, I don't know, stages is probably not the right way to talk about it, but wherever I am, you know, that it feels like a way of opening up and opening out and making things bigger.
I'm sorry, I said too many things and moving very fast. But I meant to stay at the first thing I said, which was, don't you think there is a mystical aspect to this, for lack of a better word, and I apologize, that transcends this Ann Kaufman brain?
Don't know how to answer that. Don't know. Have no idea.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, no, it's like, well, I think that, well, you know.
Let's say one or two more things, and then I think we're kind of running longer than we should. So maybe especially a couple of people haven't said anything. Yeah.
Hannah Brown. One of the things that was coming to mind about, you know, the arising of those flashes of sense experience is for me to always remember it's now. And thinking it's from another time is actually a mistake of the mind. So it's like,
that's
always
great.
Thinking there's a reference to a past and a reference
that's
to a future.
Great.
That is the trick of mind.
It's
unreal. You know? And just to vividly experience this now, recognizing it's now.
That's great. There's one of the texts that I don't understand very well is the Dogen text Uji, which is, as far as I sort of understand a little of it, partly about things like that. Thank you. Is anybody else? Yeah, John.
Actually, who was it that was just speaking?
Anna Brown.
Oh, hi. That was, I wanted to talk about that because today I had this sense thing happen, but I wasn't meditating. I was sitting in my camp
I think a lot of our practice is letting stuff poke through, you know, and that when you do that, things start feeling a lot more porous and a lot less tidily organized than they often do, and that's really useful too. So any one or two other, anything else people have said anything?
No, I was just thinking, I'm so grateful about this conversation because I'm a fairly new Zen meditator, done a lot of meditation, but then I never wanted to really bother with because I was like, well, you're not supposed to be thinking and that's not fun, so. And I was struggling this last 2 days, feeling so tired and also thinking, where's the fun? And this kind of thing is so wonderful because of somebody who really knew I had fun all along. I just wasn't aware of it. Because so much has been going on. I've been so tired. And when we go to bed, I'm so tired. You know, I need a chair. I'm so tired. Whatever. And I think maybe it's more the way the unconscious, where do people, we were talking about where we get tired is where it starts poking through.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So maybe this
right.
is what's happening.
Yeah.
Now
it would
be like a sieve with all these holes and all this stuff is coming through, and it's totally exciting.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Yeah. I have two responses to that. One is I remember going into Joan one time and saying, well, all this would be really great. You know, what's happening in this street teaching me if I didn't think that. And she said, yeah, isn't that how it is? You know, I mean, so, and then also my experience of long retreats is that there are a lot of hyperspace buttons in them, you know, that anything can turn into anything completely different in an instant, you know. So just the willingness to sort of sit with and in whatever's going on. And not to be too anxious for it to turn into something else. Yeah. So I think we should probably.
I have 30 seconds.
Oh yeah, please.
This morning when we were walking the labyrinth, I've been thinking about the brain a lot too, and I thought, well, the labyrinth looks just like a brain, and each person was a thought.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, thank you. That's good. All right. So on that thought, I want to thank all of you for your attention and the wonderful quality of your engagement and the wonderful discussions.